never give your social security number or bank account information to anyone unless you initiated contact.
Treasury, Social Security, VA, and other government agencies will never contact you by phone, email, or text for this information.
Watch your accounts carefully.
Don't be a victim. Visit stopfraud.gov or call 877-ID-THEFT to learn more.
It's 6 p.m. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time once again for another edition of Off the Wall. Right. This is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by, who are you?
Kyle.
Right. How you doing?
Fine.
Do you mind? I'm trying to read this, and everybody just keeps interfering, getting in my way, telling me to do things.
What's with the book?
It's a book. I'm reading a book, and
yeah,
I read a damn book without being harassed by everybody in the world.
It's a show. We have a show. You're also running.
It's a charade, Kyle. That's what it is.
Engineering.
Well, I'm supposed to. Okay, fine. I guess I'll just have to read this later. Yeah, it's a book. I got this book today. It's a good book. It really is riveting reading.
I actually was. You shared it a little bit. You let me flip through and
you grabbed it, and I waited a second before grabbing it back. So yeah, I shared that much.
Mm-hmm.
Because you wanted to see what was in it as well.
Yeah.
Listen to this. Wow, that really is a loud sound. That's the book dropping on the table. Maybe if the book dropped on the floor, it'd be more dramatic. Wow, it really is.
It's pretty loud.
The thing about a book, you can't break it. This is the book.
You know what that book told me? You know, that book told me that General Mattis has a lot of books.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So you learned that in the second you grabbed the book from me.
He reads.
You learned about other books.
He's known as the Warrior Monk.
This, of course, is Fear, Trump in the White House by Bob Woodward. We got our copy today because today is the day it came out. Everything you heard before this has just been excerpts, and now we've got the real thing. And I can go back to the very beginning. I've been tearing through this. How do we? Wow. Okay. Well, can I just start the story? It's all based upon dialogue. I mean, a lot of it. Hundreds of hours of interviews from firsthand sources, meeting notes, personal diaries, files, and documents. It's like he was a fly on the wall.
Yeah, and that... Go ahead. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it goes right into some of the stuff that was mentioned in the run-up to its release. And there it is. It's talking about Cohn.
It is. It talks about all of them.
And actually includes the letter that he took. There's a picture.
This is some... Did the CD skip at the very last second? I think it did. Okay, well, it's stuck at 3 seconds to go. All right, let's see if it makes it by the end of the show. Oh, there it goes.
Wow.
I'm not touching. That's got 1.23
seconds. 29.29
seconds. Either we have to clean the disc or we have to clean the player.
Can we afford another copy of that? Can we burn another one? I'll chip in. I have a dollar.
It's not that we can't afford it. It's that I'm worried about the burning process.
Come on, I care about this show.
I don't like...
Here, I have a dollar.
I'll burn sources. No, I won't do that. But that's probably the worst thing I could say.
Well, Bob Woodward won't.
No, because we do get things. We get things in our secure drop.
In alleyways.
If you have something to leak, and I know we say this on the other show, but we can say it here as well because, hey, you know, people... listening to Off the Wall may have some juicy material of one sort or another. And, you know, based on what happened last week, I'm pretty sure the White House is listening to this show. Somebody inside the White House is. But if you have something you want to give to us, simply go to 2600.com/securedrop and you'll see all the instructions on how you can securely give us documents of any sort. We won't know who you are. It will be encrypted. Everything will protect you. Assuming you don't bellow from the mountaintops who you are and what you're doing, you won't have the source burned by us. That's for sure. You have to use the Tor browser, which you can easily get, and it's really painless. It's a lot more painless than it was setting it up in the first place, which you did for quite a while, Kyle. And I can't believe you pulled it off.
I dove right in as soon as we got a sense of what it involved. I looked at it and was daunted and continued to be daunted for months. It took me about a year in entirety because of spare time and spare expertise being short.
Not a year sitting at the terminal just, tearing your hair out solid, but basically whenever, like you said, when we had, spare time to work on this. But a lot of steps have to be taken, and you have to do it right. And there are things that you can, get wrong and you have to start over again. But when you finish, it is worth it. It is really worth it.
It adds that sort of baseline of anonymity and layers that Tor browser is known for. And then, it's kind of the evolution. We've always had a GPG key. for sending GPG encrypted email. And of course, you can send letters and plain text email to otw@2600.com. Write in about the show, about anything we talk about, or send us something. Send us documents. We love that kind of stuff. But anyway, this is sort of the evolution from plain text to encrypted to now sort of double blind, I guess, is the way you would describe this submission and submission method. So it's cool.
We join other journalistic entities like New York Times, Washington Post, The Intercept, The New Yorker. And we're in there. 2600 is in there as well. And we have gotten material. We can't really go into specifics, obviously. But we have gotten some interesting material that either we pass on to other more appropriate journalistic outlets, or we follow up. We can communicate with the people that are sending us things still without knowing who they are. So we can send back and forth messages, and the person simply has to go and check. And we can ask a question. They can give us an answer. But we've gotten all kinds of documents. We've gotten audio files. We've gotten video files. We've gotten everything you can imagine. Most of it isn't very interesting. I'll grant you that. But that's the nature of when you get things. Most of it isn't very interesting. So it's great to see that actually happening, though.
And this was something we started basically middle of the summer with the Circle of Hope event, basically being sort of the kickoff, and really, it's such a short time. It's amazing how people have taken to it.
What was interesting is I believe it was at HopeX that the Secure Drop Project was announced in the first place.
Right? Isn't that
two conferences ago? And then at this conference, we're actually using it as well, and many members of the Freedom of the Press Foundation who run this.
Fantastic group.
Yeah, they really are. They're at the conference as well and explaining how to use it and the process involved and inspiring more people to do more things in the future. So who knows, 4 years from now, what we'll be using and talking about.
Support good software projects like that. I mean, they really are crucial. They create great tools for people and that help leverage liberty and freedom and all that good privacy stuff.
Never before now, I don't think it is demonstrated itself to be so important to have sources, to have journalists out there that are seeking the truth and reporting on it and catching all kind of hell for it, but doing it nonetheless. It is a hard job. And, I know there are people who don't appreciate journalism, but there are so many people who do. And I think this is the shining period where we realize how important, how valuable, how vital it is, especially in this age of Facebook, where anything can be news, anything can be believed, any fact can just be considered a different fact. But the real facts are the things that you get from actual investigative journalism and true sources and evidence you can back up.
Yeah, and one other thing comes to mind is just that this stuff hadn't existed 10 years ago. I mean, there were not a lot of really well put together methods for doing this, but I'm really proud of journalism as a vocation, just having risen to the occasion and so many journalistic entities, even when they don't agree, having supported one another and shared about best practices and operating procedures, how to take care of oneself and protect stories that really do need to surface and need public scrutiny.
Now, we have this book, Fear, Trump in the White House by Bob Woodward. We talked about it last week. And just the source notes on this alone is phenomenal. And of course, you need to give source notes when you have material like this. But let me just start at the first chapter, just at the beginning, so you can get a taste of it. In August 2010, 6 years before taking over Donald Trump's winning presidential campaign, Steve Bannon, then 57 and a producer of right-wing political films, answered his phone. "What are you doing tomorrow?" asked David Bossie, a longtime House Republican investigator and conservative activist who had chased Bill and Hillary Clinton scandals for almost two decades. "Dude," Bannon replied, "I'm cutting these effing films I'm making for you." Right away, I can't say some of the words in here. The 2010 midterm congressional elections were coming up. It was the height of the Tea Party movement, and Republicans were showing momentum. "Dave, we're literally dropping two more films. I'm editing. I'm working 20 hours a day at Citizens that's the end of the quote. At Citizens United, the Conservative Political Action Committee, Bossie headed to churn out his anti-Clinton films. "Can you come with me up to New York?" "For what?" "To see Donald Trump," Bossie said. "What about?" He's thinking of running for president, Bossie said. Of what country? Bannon asked. Of what country? Oh, Bannon, you cracked me up. No, seriously, Bossie insisted. He had been meeting and working with Trump for months. Trump had asked for a meeting. I don't have time to jerk off, dude, Bannon said. Donald Trump's never running for president. Forget it. Against Obama? Forget it. I don't have time for effing nonsense. Don't you want to meet him? No, I have no interest in meeting him. Trump had once given Bannon a 30-minute interview for a Sunday afternoon radio show called The Victory Sessions, which Bannon had run out of Los Angeles and billed as, quote, the thinking man's radio show, unquote. Hey, that's our slogan. That's our slogan, Bannon.
It is.
See you in court. This guy's not serious, Bannon said. I think he is serious, Bossie said. Trump was a TV celebrity and had a famous show, The Apprentice, that was number one on NBC some weeks. There's no downside for us to go and meet with him. Well, Bannon finally agreed to go to New York City to Trump Tower. If you want to hear the rest, you got to get the book. That was a book drop.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like that all the way through.
It's all conversations, which is great because it's that other side, that other sort of part of what's going on. And imagine you read this through and reflect.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, you know, the entirety of what you've been hearing, and then this sort of inside perspective. I'm sure once you're through with it, you look at some of this stuff and have a lot to consider. It's probably very instructive as far as looking at developments and maybe making sort of conclusions about what's ahead.
Absolutely. And, you know, Bob Woodward, the author of this book, has an incredible reputation. I know you all hear, you know, on Fox News and everything that this is all made up. Do you really think this guy would go out and make up stories? This is all based on actual evidence, actual conversations. There's tape recordings. There's, written documentation. This is a guy who got two Pulitzer Prizes, one for Washington Post coverage of the Watergate scandal, along with Carl Bernstein, and the other in 2003 as a lead reporter for coverage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, which, by the way, happened 17 years ago today. Not only did it happen 17 years ago today, it happened on this day of the week. I don't know what you call that kind of an anniversary where the day is the same as the date. But it was a Tuesday. It was a Tuesday Tuesday morning when it happened. This is not a guy that's going to make things up. This is real. And if you want to find out what's actually going on, I would definitely recommend reading this, whether it's electronically, whether it's on paper. Pick a number, Kyle. Pick a page number.
I'm sorry. 313.
313. Okay. All right. So it happened to be that many pages. So let's see what we got here. Every page has something interesting.
I would. Go on.
No, go ahead.
I just want to say this show started right around 2001.
2003, actually, is when the show started.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It started right after 9/11 and before the invasion.
Uh-huh. Let's see. There's not a whole lot of actual Trump. I'll tell you what's going on. Still, General Nicholson kept saying that he would win in Afghanistan. Mattis didn't like it. The secretary is very unhappy with what he just said, meaning Nicholson, and we're trying to rein him in, one Pentagon official privately confided. If the language of the commander-in-chief was about winning, it was hard to criticize the ground commander for using it, but the intelligence indicated that it was heading to worse, not better, next year. The president said we're going to win, and you can't define that as a stalemate forever. At some point, people are going to recognize you can't succeed there, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, well, it's relevant. I found something interesting before. Let me just try and track this down. This is after Charlottesville, okay? Where Trump was pressured to actually make a statement condemning Nazis. Remember?
It was at the ground floor of Trump Tower, and he was kind of standing there in front of the elevators.
It looked like a hostage video. Looking stiff and uncomfortable, like someone coerced to speak in a hostage video. I swear I just read that now, but that is how people described it. The president said, no matter the color of our skin, we all live under the same laws. We all salute the same great flag. We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, he said, singling out the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups. We will defend and protect the sacred rights of all Americans so every citizen is free to follow their dreams in their hearts and to express the love and joy in their souls. It was a 5-minute speech that could have been given by President Reagan or Obama. General Kelly told the senior staff, make sure you tell him how great it was. He had been chief of staff less than 3 weeks. Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn were there to greet Trump at the elevator back to the residence. They showered praise on him. That was a great speech, Cohn said. That was one of your finest moments as president. It was in the grand tradition of unifying and taking the high road of racial hearing. And later they told Porter they didn't know how he had managed to convince Trump. Porter felt it was a moment of victory, of actually doing some good for the country. He had served the president well. This made the endless hours of nonstop work worth it. Trump then left to watch some Fox. Rob O'Neill, a former Navy SEAL, Team 6 leader and author, generally praised Trump for being specific, but added, that's almost an admission of, okay, I was wrong, and I'm sort of negotiating on this. Fox correspondent Kevin Cork said, some 48 hours into the biggest domestic challenge of his young presidency, Mr. Trump has made a course correction. Now, get this. The suggestion that he had admitted doing wrong and was unsteady infuriated the president. That was the biggest effing mistake I've made, the president told Porter. You never make those concessions. You never apologize. I didn't do anything wrong in the first place. Why look weak? Though Porter had not written the original draft, he had spent almost 4 hours editing it with Trump, providing the accommodating language. But strangely, Trump did not direct his rage at Porter. I can't believe I got forced to do that, Trump said, apparently still not blaming Porter, but venting directly to him. That's the worst speech I've ever given. I'm never going to do anything like that again. He continued to stew about what he had said and how it was a huge mistake. Condemning Nazis, that's how he felt about it. It was a huge mistake. He'll never do anything like that again. The things you learn, the things you pick up from just reading the dialogue that took place, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, and I think that was sort of on the press tour what Bob Woodward's been saying, coming away from writing it in a release. And we'll see as many more Americans read this or not. I don't know. They surprise us all the time. But that he's basically ringing or sounding the alarm bell. And that was actually what we heard when the letter came out, that op-ed, was that basically someone was pulling the fire, you know, the alarm to really sound it and get people active and moving, not just sort of as a surprise in this sort of campaign midterm run up.
Well, anyway, that is our nation as it is today, and go ahead.
I was really surprised this morning. I just wanted to say one other thing on 9/11, on Washington Journal, just how many people in this country. Now, I don't know if this is
Washington Journal, that's the show on
C-SPAN.
On C-SPAN that airs every morning.
Yeah. Yeah. They also play it on their radio program. I think it's WCSP in Washington. Anyway, they have a call-in, and I think the first question was just basically about 9/11. The whole hour. A lot of people were calling in about 9/11 being a conspiracy. And it's just really amazing how many people in this country don't actually believe the official story, whatever you think. And it got to the point where the person taking calls was starting to say, okay, yeah, we dedicated a lot of time this hour to conspiracies. Let's take another call. Then someone called in and chastised her. Or him for cutting people off and trying to divert away from that. I mean, there's really just a ton of passion disbelief, I guess, coming away from that. There are also some good calls that I really liked. One woman said something I think that was really poignant, that we have sort of a collective PTSD after that event. And I think that's really true. And I don't think we've handled it in a healthy way as a nation. You know, in so far as how we appear to other countries and the sort of nation building and protectionism and nationalism, you know, being tough, not looking weak, as Trump was just saying. But I think that we really need to reflect more on days like today on the impact of what we do and, you know, the sort of things like Zionism and the religious movements and various other things.
I heard a great term the other day, Christian Zionism. Mm-hmm. And that's basically when you have your evangelicals that blindly support the state of Israel. And it's not because, you know, they accept the Jewish people at all. It's because it ties into their prophecy of the end of the world and, you know, certain players being in place in Jerusalem at a certain time. And it's just, it's really kind of a dangerous way of thinking because it basically oppresses many, many people and is blind to actually, what is really going on in the world and what is right and what is wrong.
I read a story that a red heifer was born in Jerusalem, and this is a candidate to be slaughtered at the building of the third temple, which marks the prophecy of of the judgment day.
Wait, when is all this happening? And
I don't know. Ask some Zionists, but yeah,
some candidate. What, they somebody running in this
they
election,
sacrifice
or?
A red heifer apparently for the construction of the third temple in Jerusalem,
wait,
and this
who's
is
red
somehow.
Heifer?
I don't know. I just read an article about it. But this is the kind of stuff you see. I don't know if it's real or not. I'm sure Zionists will tell you. But, so the judgment day is upon us.
Well, you know, this is it definitely goes into the realm of the absurd in certain ways. But, you know, it's also a danger of buying too much into the negative about all this and then just winding up hating on other people and using all kinds of religious and racial prejudices to gain something else, which is equally ignorant. We have to look at these situations, you know, in a kind of a balanced way, and that's the last thing that we've been doing lately.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as humans, I think from like a humanist perspective of just nations and that sort of NATO and like UN, like, hey, you know, we're different, but we can sort of coexist and stuff like that. Religion getting involved is just, I don't know, you it gets sort of irrational in my perspective.
It does, because people get very emotional and they start pointing at their holy books and nobody else really matters and everyone else is going to hell, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's important to look at these things with, some semblance of justice, some semblance of fairness. Now, there's this organization, the International Criminal Court. You may have heard of them. These are the people that go out and prosecute crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes of various sorts. They meet in The Hague. You may have heard about them prosecuting dictators of various sorts. There are 123 countries that have signed on to this. I don't know why everybody hasn't signed on to it. It seems pretty common sense, but I'll give you a sense of the countries that have signed on. Afghanistan is in alphabetical order. Afghanistan, Albania, Andorra, Antigua and Barbuda, Argentina, Australia. As you can see, every country in Western Europe, pretty much Japan is there. The countries that have not signed on are countries like China, Russia, the United States. That's the company we're keeping right now. Yesterday, that idiot, John Bolton, National Security Advisor, called the court, the International Criminal Court, the court that prosecutes the people who are accused of genocide and war crimes, called them illegitimate and threatened them, because they had the audacity of saying that Americans are not immune from being prosecuted if they commit war crimes. And apparently, the thinking here is that if Americans commit war crimes, they're Americans. They get a pass. We don't want any foreigners judging our people. My God, this is scary. This is like Third Reich type material here, where we do not have to obey your laws because we are better than you. And while he didn't quite say that, he's pretty much on the doorstep of saying that, to actually threaten a court of law that 123 nations, including every single country in Western Europe, Canada, Mexico, everybody, except for countries with horrible human rights records. I'll get you the list of those countries that didn't sign it. You can tell me if anybody there is a paradise. But to hear those words coming out of our own government, it made me shudder. It made me realize, wow, these are the bad guys. We have the bad guys running things now. they want to be able to commit war crimes with impunity. They want to be able to get away with it. They are threatening actual courts of justice. And, you know, it didn't get very much coverage in the press, unfortunately. It really should have. This is something that is huge in the rest of the world. My God, I mean, I knew this guy Bolton was an idiot, but now I see how evil he really is. I just wonder where is this going to head?
Yeah, my attitude is that this is sort of this is what Capital thinks of your little religious conflict, or, you know, however sovereign you think you are in the world. You know, we live in a globalized world, and the sort of AI of corporations will do what it will. It will not stop profit seeking. So, yeah, you may blame individual, you know, other religions or nations for interfering, but this basically, you know, is what projection of that authority does. It does not want to be held accountable and does not allow to be stopped. You know, it does not allow for you know, opinion about how we handle these things. And, you know, when we're threatened, we'll stop at nothing. So and that I think is.
But are we threatened by having people held up to a code of justice? Is that really a threat to us?
Well, it's a threat to capital. So our interests there, our interests of our allies. You know, if that if terror and disruptive stuff is, you know, getting in the way of profits, you know, whatever religion is involved, the manifestation of that is going to weigh in. And they just happen to have a lot of fuel and a lot of munitions, and they're willing to use it. And it's sort of agnostic. You know, you might blame it as Christians or Westerners, but it's really, in my opinion, the gears of profits that need to go on and can't be disrupted with whatever age-old conflict. That's where we are now, I think. And so next time you're fawning over a vet, you know, they might be a murderer and a rapist.
Well, yeah, but, you know, to be fair, you have to be accused of something. It's not just that that people are getting away with war crimes and it's not being noted. The thing here is that if they are accused of war crimes, we want them to just be protected. And that's wrong. And I think any vet would agree with that, just like good cops would agree that, you know, bad cops should not be protected. Although, you know, with all the pressure, the peer pressure that people get, it's hard to do that. And that is what's unhealthy. That's something that has to be attacked and recognized. And we are so far from doing that.
Yeah. And, if there's no mechanism, you're not going to participate. You're not going to, you know, when international laws are broken, you're not going to allow investigations or even entertain the specter of it or as a possibility to keep your processes in check. It's suspect. It's really, really suspect. And it's a double standard, you know. It's you know, then how can we be so surprised when people push back against our sort of militaristic imposition, and knowing that, you know, we might not see it that way, but the people who are at the effect of this see us and see the sort of crass carelessness of it.
Well, on this day, 17 years after 9/11, it's sad to see this and to realize that so much has been lost as a result, and not because of the terrorists who attacked on that day, because of our own people. Now, if you want to say 9/11 was an inside job, I agree with it on that basis, that 9/11 happened, and then people worked on their own agendas. People in power worked on certain agendas to take away rights, to impose certain restrictions, and to condemn various democratic institutions such as international courts of justice. And in so doing, we join other states. And let me know when I hit a bastion of democracy, a country that you know, gets it right, a country that has a good human rights record. Because these are the people that we are now allying ourselves, not people, the governments that we are allying ourselves with now, the ones that feel as we do. Okay, in addition to to Russia. We have Azerbaijan. We have Belarus, Bhutan, Brunei, China, Cuba, Equatorial Guinea, Ethiopia, India, Indonesia, Iraq. They all have pretty bad human rights records, as far as I know. Kazakhstan, Kiribati, North Korea, Laos, Lebanon, Libya, Malaysia, Mauritania, Micronesia, Myanmar, Nepal. Anything ringing a bell yet? No. Places that you'd be happy settling and criticizing the government over there? No. Nicaragua, maybe? I don't know this country. Niue. What country is that? Hang on. I just got to click on this. It's an island country in the South Pacific Ocean. Okay. Well, it's just another island country over there. There's so many of them.
That one.
Yeah. Pakistan. Palau, I think is how you pronounce it. Papua New Guinea. Qatar. Rwanda. Saudi Arabia. Singapore. Somalia. South Sudan. No?
I wouldn't go any of those. No, sorry.
Sri Lanka, Swaziland, Togo, Tonga, Turkey, Turkmenistan, Tuvalu, Vatican City. I don't know what they're doing there.
And Vietnam. Done that.
Well, we were in Vatican City once. I'm not sure why Vatican City doesn't. It might be that they just overlooked it, or they're too small, or
I'd
something.
I'd go to Vietnam.
They're the size of the Stony Brook campus. How many human rights violations, other than all the molestations and
things. Do you really want to get going
on that? Okay, maybe that's the reason. I don't know. But the thing is, there's no Germany. There's no Belgium. There's no France. There's no no countries there that have, you know, problems. But also, they are in the thick of Western civilization and accountability. I know there's exceptions. I know this is, so stop writing those emails right now. I know that. But they are subject to higher justice if it comes to that. If it comes to that. You know, maybe our soldiers haven't done anything. Maybe they're completely pure. Wouldn't that be great? But to say that no matter what, we will not accept this, and to call that kind of a court illegitimate, it's sickening.
Well, I feel like our service members in general are pretty well behaved in areas of conflict, in general, on the whole, compared to other militaries, militias, militants, whatever, in that sphere. There's definitely a lot of procedure and protocol and chains and hierarchies to observe and supervise, but it does not mean it, so in other words, this is sort of a bad look. I mean, why look so defensive? Because, you know, if you are subject to this, something is going to come out. I mean, that is just, it's just so reflexive and such a redressing of this international consortium as you laid out. It's really kind of makes it suspect, as I said, more suspect than it needs to be, because I think generally, other than, the bombing and campaigns we do, I think when troops are actually on the ground, I mean, yeah, there's killing, of course, but, we generally follow international, like the Geneva Convention and such rules.
If we truly believe the things that we say, we should be leading this kind of a thing.
We
should be a part of the International Court of International Criminal Court, finding those war criminals, those people guilty of genocide,
even if they are our own, and be willing to have reconciliation and go through that process like any other nation would be expected to.
We're often called the cops of the world, but like cops in this country, we don't seem to feel that they should be held up to justice. They're of a higher class of human, I suppose. So you have, humanity, and then you have Americans. Much like in this country, you have civilians, and then you have cops. Now, this story in Dallas, I'm sure we've all heard of. This is where a Dallas cop somehow entered a guy's apartment, thinking it was hers, and killed the guy. Killed the guy in his own apartment. Now, that is outrageous. That is insane. That is unforgivable. But what almost manages to top that is the reaction since that. The reaction from the authorities, where basically, you know, this person who did this was first put on a paid administrative leave, not charged with anything for days, and basically given every opportunity defend herself and get her story straight. I just want to read a little bit from a story off of ABC. The arrest warrant affidavit, and she wasn't named. Her name is Amber Geiger, but her name was not revealed for a long time. You try this. No, don't try this, but for God's sake, if you basically break into a cop's house and shoot them dead and say, oh, I was confused. I thought it was my place. Sorry. Okay, please don't give my name out to the media. Let me go home. Let me get my story straight. In a couple of days, you know, I'll get a grand jury together. We'll see what happens. Yeah, you know, that's how society works, right? Is that really the life we lead? No, it's not. That's insane. Why are cops a different class of human? They really aren't. This person did something so obviously wrong, should have been taken into custody on the spot, and was not. Now, the arrest warrant for that police officer shot a man after she says she mistakenly entered his apartment has prompted more questions and answers for the victim's family, not just for them, for everybody. And their lawyers are calling the officer's scenario highly implausible. Now, note who's not calling it that. The authorities themselves. Now, the narrative that Amber Geiger has given to investigators has been contradicted by at least two independent witnesses and flies in the face of facts they've gathered at the Thursday night killing in Dallas. Now, that's...
There's video and stuff, too. There's, like, witnesses and so on.
Yeah, that's what I just said. Independent witnesses.
The whole complex, like a building.
Yeah. Now, you know, the facts as they're presenting them are already absurd and crazy as they are. But according to their lawyers, and this is easily backed up, it shouldn't just be their lawyers saying this. It should be, you know, reporters saying this. It should be the authorities themselves saying this. Independent witnesses have already come forward to say that they heard this officer pounding on the door, demanding to be let in. Which, right away, why are you demanding to be let into your own apartment? That doesn't really make much sense. The contradictions begin to build from there. Now, her police union president said the Texas Rangers Division has interviewed at least one of the witnesses mentioned by attorneys and still concluded after an independent investigation that the evidence amounted to a manslaughter charge, not murder. Don't get me wrong. She's going to have to answer in a court of law, says Sergeant Mike Mehta of the Dallas Police Association. It needs to be fair and unbiased, and right now, it's not unbiased. It's beginning to turn into a political hunt. Oh, come on! My God, a political hunt? She went in and killed a guy in his own apartment, and you're calling it political. You're saying that it's basically a biased prosecution. I got news for you, officer. Every prosecution is biased because you're accusing somebody of something. All right, you believe they did something wrong. And what you guys are doing is bending over backwards to protect somebody who is so obviously wrong and, you know, giving them every benefit of the doubt at the expense of the trust of the community. Now, from reading the arrest warrant affidavit, this guy said you can understand how a mistake can be made. Really? How? How exactly do you make that kind of mistake? And I could see going to the wrong apartment, but how do you basically break into somebody else's house and then shoot somebody else without realizing that you're doing something wrong? How do you do that? How do you justify that? You know, and would you do the same thing if the tables were turned? If this was a civilian who went into somebody else's apartment and shot them dead on sight, would you be saying, oh, I understand how a mistake could be made? No, of course you wouldn't be doing that. It's a double standard. And it's so incredibly wrong. Now, according to this cop's report or statement, she arrived home from work about 10 p.m., parked her car on the fourth floor of the building? I don't understand what that is. There a garage next to the building? I'm just reading what's reported on the ABC here. She parked her car on the fourth floor of the building instead of the third floor, which corresponded to her apartment. So I guess they have a garage or something. So she lost track of how many floors she went up. Okay, that can happen, I suppose. Her apartment is directly beneath the apartment of the person she killed. Geiger entered the building and walked down the four-floor hallway to what she thought was her apartment. She inserted a unique door key with an electronic chip into the door keyhole. The door, which was slightly ajar, prior to Geiger's arrival, fully opened under the force of the key insertion. When the door opened, she saw a large silhouette in a nearly completely dark apartment and believed it was a burglar. She basically was still in full uniform. She no longer had her body cam, which she had left at work. She drew her firearm, gave verbal commands that were ignored by the victim. So right away, the warrant is stating that the victim is responsible for their own death. You see how this gets distorted and biased when you have somebody who cannot answer for themselves. Geiger fired her handgun 2 times, striking the victim in the torso. She entered the apartment, immediately called 911, requesting police and EMS, and provided first aid, basically painting her to be this angel. She immediately called the cops and provided first aid. Yeah. Due to the interior darkness of the apartment, Geiger turned on the interior lights while on the phone with 911. Upon being asked where she was located by emergency dispatchers, she returned to the front door to observe the address and discovered she was at the wrong apartment. Now, according to the lawyers of the victims, that just seems highly implausible. It would have been uncharacteristic for the victim to leave his door ajar, for one thing. He's a very meticulous young man. He paid attention to detail, and his security was something that was always forefront on his mind. So when he went into a room, he closed the door behind him. He locked the door. He put his keys in a specific place. Another attorney for the family said it was also troubling that Geiger says she fired into the apartment after seeing a large silhouette inside and believing it was a burglar. She gives verbal commands, and then she shoots into the dark apartment. Not knowing anything about who this individual is or anything, she shoots into a dark apartment. So it's going to have to be determined, is this the actions of a prudent, well-trained police officer who at this time now has assumed that she is investigating a burglary and that she then must comply with her training, her experience, her education that she got from the Dallas Police Department? It seems to be contradictory of a well-trained police officer. An attorney said that Geiger's purported actions after shooting the victim was suspect and full of inconsistencies. From the fact that when you look at an affidavit, and I'm thinking that I'm at my house and I call 911 because someone was just shot, well, the very first thing that I'm going to do is I'm not going to go outside and look at my address. I'm going to give them my address right there on the phone. I'm going to say I'm on the phone. My address is this. Why does she have to go outside to verify the address? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's such a troubling story. And it's just, it does nothing. The reaction to this does nothing to legitimize the role of police in the community. When you see how people are given favorable treatment and every opportunity to clear themselves, and then even arrest warrants paint them as good people when they obviously have done something horrendous. How do you have any faith in law enforcement after this?
I don't trust, and I think a lot of people do not trust the police at all. And I think the military is in the same way. This double standard and this shoot first thing that's a part of their training. And I kind of even want to tie this into the NRA and the proliferation of weaponry, because the reason they're trained this way, instead of like in the other incident she had been involved in, someone who may have had a mental illness of some kind or was on some kind of substance under the influence and so on, you know, the possibility of a deadly weapon being on someone justifies them drawing weapons and doing things like shooting at an individual without knowing whether they're being threatened with a deadly weapon. It's just the presumption that in our society, everyone's armed. So that's then ingrained in their training, and you get this thing of like they get, you know, they're off duty even, and they have tunnel vision, and you know, you have no idea if she'll ever be evaluated, like her mental state, or ever even questioned. It's just that, you know, okay, we got the story that she followed all the procedures, all those boxes are checked, why even question? I think she was in some kind of state of psychosis or, you know, overworked or something where, you know, you make mistakes like this or you're still on even when you're like supposed to be off duty, relaxing, you know, going home and getting rest, which I again, I feel like she needs. But this entire philosophy of assuming all Americans have weapons is a part of the socialization of weaponry in our society. When we act and justify and validate the possibility of weapons being everywhere, we then train for just that instead of the real thing, which is, you know, substance abuse, mental disorders, and economic disparity, you know, and other conflict that is sort of really what is eating at society alongside this proliferation of weapons.
It's just, you know, it annoys me so much just to see all the bias aimed, you know, even in the media, talking about how she worked a 12-hour shift, basically saying, oh, she was tired, she didn't know what she was doing, giving her every benefit of the doubt, and meanwhile, the only story that they're looking at is her story. They're not looking at what other witnesses are reporting. Obviously, they can't look at what the victim experienced. It's just so incredibly unfair to have this kind of a thing reported as fact when there are so many. I'm sorry, Trump is tweeting, and honestly, I honestly don't care what Trump is saying right now. But it's really disheartening because you see so many different cases, you know, one by one. Okay, people aren't safe in their cars. They're not safe when they follow orders. They're not safe in their own homes. Where does it end? What would happen if this guy had shot her? She was the one illegally entering the apartment. If he had killed her, do you think he'd be out on bail right now? Do you think the media and the cops would be defending him? Not likely. Not very likely at all.
No, he'd probably have like a spinal injury from when he was taken in. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't buy the tiredness thing. You know, a lot of us work. I've worked 12-hour shifts. You know, I've worked 14-hour shifts. I've worked 20, 24 hours.
Have you killed anybody when you did?
No, I haven't shot anyone.
I thought you were building up to that.
I'm sorry. This country, we all work, a lot of us. And I just, you know, you choose a certain career. You have a schedule. You know, what are you not doing in your life to prepare yourself for work? Again, mm-hmm. The accountability. She does not seem cut out for this job.
Well, I don't think she'll be patrolling.
Something about how her union and her department is preparing her is inadequate, and that's, I think, you know, it's just there's no excuse. A lot of people are tired. A lot of people work.
Uh huh. Absolutely. And you know, here's the thing: we honestly don't know what happened, but we know what we know. We know the facts as they have come out, and based on those facts, you treat somebody in a particular way. That has not happened. And that's really, you know, that's the first step right there. You find out the truth in the whole, hearings, whatever. But at first, when something like this happens, you take the appropriate action, and that was not done. She was not treated the way anybody else would have been treated. And right away, how do you recover from that? It's very, very difficult. You've lost the trust of the people. So that's the kind of thing that has to stop. The cops have to be treated, have to stop being treated like superhumans. Americans in the world stage have to stop being treated like they're above everybody else in the world. Doesn't work. No matter how right you think you are, it doesn't work. I'd like to close on a more positive note on this, the 17th anniversary of 9/11, because we've talked about a lot of negative things this hour. But this is something that I thought was just so awesomely cool. And that is that the Port Jefferson Library will be hosting Long Island's first kids drag queen story hour. That's right. Drag queen story hour is just what it sounds like. A drag queen spends 45 minutes reading picture books. The organizers say they choose books with themes of acceptance, tolerance, and embracing who you are. The drag queen also sings kid-friendly songs with the kids, such as The Wheels on the Bus or Itsy Bitsy Spider, and helps them make a craft, such as a magic wand, paper plate fans, or a crown. The activity is geared to kids ages 4 to 8. And such events have been held at New York City Library since 2016. This is the first time the nonprofit group is sending a representative to a Long Island library. That's according to Jonathan Hamilt, co-founder of the New York City chapter. The organization was founded in San Francisco in 2015, currently has chapters in more than 40 states, Sweden, Toronto, Vancouver, Canada. We don't think of ourselves as cutting edge, but we are a little bit ahead of the curve when it comes to something like this. That's according to Tom Donlin, director of the Port Jefferson Library. And hats off to them for doing something really super positive, fun, and something that will influence those kids positively for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, they'll be aware of you know, the differences and you know, positive things going on in society, instead of you know, feeling as though they're not welcome if they are you know, different or you know, questioning and going through that stuff, or just, you know, straight kids, all kinds of kids, they're growing up in a world where you have a lot of possibility, and this needs to be encouraged. I think I don't want to go back to the church and stuff, but groups that have an opportunity to lead, they really ought to. And when you suppress and disavow and are closed-minded, you create unhealthy situations. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, an opportunity that the church missed. And this is really cool to see from an educational perspective. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And let's hope it's the beginning of more things like that, because diversity is the key to understanding and to growing as well. And we see it condemned in so many places. It's good to see it embraced in others, especially in places so close. So that'll be happening in Port Jefferson. I don't know if there was a date on that.
Yes.
If you're 4 to 8 years old, when is that taking place? September 22nd. So that's coming up in just a few days. Hey, we're out of time. I want to thank everybody for listening. Write to us, otw@2600.com. We will see you next week. Have a good night.
When I was a baby, I looked like a pig. My nose was a snout and my ears were too big. My mother would poke at the hole in the back of my head where my brain was exposed. And I could not know it then, but I never again would recapture those wonderful days. When I was a baby, I fell down the well. I landed deep down in the furnace of hell. The devil would rock me to sleep, and he'd sing about cities of ivory and gold. And it took a long, long time before I could escape from that terrible hole. When I was a baby, I lived in a crib. I crawled on the ground and I ate with a bib. But then I was taken away and was sold to the circus for trinkets and beads. And I like